Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for July 9th, 2023. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and we are here talking the big shows in pro wrestling, as we do each and every Sunday night. And we've got a lot of big shows coming up as we get deeper into the summer here. Specifically tonight, we'll be talking about the G1 tournament, New Japan's annual summer blockbuster that starts next week. And we'll also talk about Impact Wrestling Slammiversary, which also takes place in about a week. And we'll talk about AEW Collision, which we are now a month into that show. We'll give our thoughts on that. We'd also like to hear from you. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Press 1. If you'd like to show up in the queue to talk, you can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. My co-host for this evening is the person I turn to whenever I need help previewing or reviewing New Japan, because he knows his stuff on the subject, pwtorch.com contributor, Javier Machado. Javier, thanks for joining me tonight to talk some New Japan and a lot of other stuff tonight.
Hey, Greg. Always great to share a Sunday with you.
Absolutely. So let's start with the G1, since that's the big in here. It's G1 33, begins July 15th. There are 32 competitors, which is an all-time high for the G1. Four blocks, so they're sticking with the A through D blocks. Just to kind of lay things out there, the A block will consist of Sanada, Chase Owens, Hikuleo, Ren Narita, Shota Umino, Yota Tsuji, Gabe Kidd, and Kaito Kiyomiya. And the B block will be Okada, Yoshihashi, Taichi, Kenta, The Great Okan, Will Ospreay, Tongaloa, and El Fantasmo. The C block, Dave Finley, Tomohiro Ishii, Evil, Tama Tonga, Shingo Takagi, Aaron Hanare, Eddie Kingston, Mikey Nichols, and the D-Block will be Hiroshi Tanahashi, Tetsuya Naito, Hiroki Goto, Zack Sabre Jr., Toru Yano, Jeff Cobb, Shane Haste, and Alex Coughlin. So just your overall thoughts on the larger field here, and if you think they did a good enough job filling it with, obviously not potential winners when you get down to the 31st and 32nd wrestler, but is it a deep enough roster for New Japan, you think, to where they can really have a productive and compelling G1 tournament with 32 members of it?
I think so, but the thing about this G1 is that this is a period of transition for New Japan. This has been the hardest one. Normally, I could narrow it down to like one or two guys who might win it, but the thing is that there are a lot of people here that are. We don't know how hard they're going to push them, pretty much. The only one I feel strong that they're going to get some level push is that A block is nuts, because they have the A block has what New Japan has dubbed their Three Musketeers of the Reiwa era. So it's the third version of the Three Musketeers, which are Shota Umino, Ren Narita, and Yota Tsuji. So that, you know, and when you add Sanada and Kaito Kiyomiya, who's from Noah, correct? And Hikuleo, which is also somebody who's, you know, seems to have been getting, you know, a heavy push, that A block is going to be nuts. And that's the thing, you know, are they going to push Zack Sabre Jr., like a Zack Sabre Jr. further? This, I think, is like going to be a surprising one, and we're going to be able to see, based on this G1, exactly like if you were to write, you'll be able to write an actual depth chart after this G1.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at the blocks, and you can see where they've peppered veterans and young lions in throughout, or recently former young lions, or those who grew up in the New Japan Strong Dojo and things like that. So some are more weighted in that direction than others. Like the A block, you've got Ren Narita, Shota Umino, Yota Tsuji, Gabe Kidd. I mean, those are, relatively speaking, very young guys and new to the newish to the G1 tournament. And then you have the block that I think intrigues me the most is the D block, where you've got a lot of old veterans who've been in this tournament for a number of years. Tanahashi, Naito, Goto, Sabre, Yano, even somebody like Jeff Cobb. I mean, he's no stranger by now to the G1 tournament as well. So that's a really interesting block to me. The other big change for this year is 20-minute time limits for these matches, whereas in the past it was 30 minutes. Do you see that playing a big role? Do you expect more time limit draws with that, or how do you see that affecting the tournament as it moves forward?
Yeah, I think for sure we're going to see it come into play. It's likely, I haven't done, the math on stuff, but it's very likely a way for them to have a situation because if what's different about this tournament is that you're not only just looking for the winner of the block, you're also looking for the runner up because there's going to be like an elimination tournament where the, I got it right here. The winner of A block will face the runner up in C block. B block will face the runner up in D block. The winner of C block, the runner up of B, and the winner of D, the runner up of A. So you're looking, at a situation where they're not going to want to book for the last night. You know, whoever wins this is number one, and whoever wins this is number two, just because, it gets repetitive. So I think we're going to end up in a situation. I think that's part of the 20 minutes that we get more draws, so that you'll end up in a situation where the winner is the number one and the loser is, like, out altogether. I think it's to create more confusion there at the end of, on how the math lays out.
So the other interesting thing when I look at this field is Eddie Kingston being the only AEW wrestler in this. In the past, we've had Lance Archer, who I think even now, while he's an AEW wrestler, still feels a little bit more like a New Japan wrestler than AEW. But given that relationship, we're coming off the Forbidden Door pay-per-view. They could have built something there for someone from AEW entering the G1. Are you surprised that Kingston, and I know there are a lot of logistical hoops that you need to jump through, especially with Collision now on the air, another 2 hours every week that AEW needs to fill. They need as much of their roster as they can have access to. And if somebody's going to be in the G1, they're not going to have access to someone for more than a month. So again, logistical challenges to having someone in AEW in the G1, but are you surprised that Kingston's the only AEW representative in the G1 this year?
I probably would have guessed one other. I just, for the same reasons you just mentioned, I just don't know who it would be. I'm sure it would have been fun to see like a Cesaro in it, but obviously he's involved in the feud with the Elite. I'm kind of surprised that they didn't really, because they did it for the Best of Super Juniors, that they would pull someone from Impact. I thought that might be a possible, that would have been a nice thing, but they normally used, the Impact people usually get pulled for the Best of Super Junior and, the Junior Tag League.
So do you ever see a situation, and this is a conversation every year when the G1 comes because of that relationship that New Japan has with AEW, do you ever see a situation where three or four AEW talents are in the G1 in a given year, or do you think that's just wishful thinking on the part of the fans and it's really not feasible with the setup that they both have right now?
I would think it's wishful thinking, just because, sending like four people over, that's a big ask. It not so much if you maybe were sending like what would be more of your developmental talent, people that used to be the wrestlers that wrestled in Dark, basically. But the thing is that those wrestlers won't be drawing. Won't be drawing as much for a tournament as prestigious as G1, and more likely you'll end up seeing people being drawn from the New Japan Strong group more likely than anything.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot now. I'm going to do this too. We're going to come back and think about this in a month when we have the finals. I want us to pick who we think is going to be the number one and number two from each block and see how close we can be. I will try. I've written it down in my notes app in my phone to come back to this because I feel like I do things like this occasionally and just forget that I've done it and never come back to it. But I do want to hold us accountable for this, Javier, and maybe I'll have you on at the end of the G1 to kind of revisit our picks. But I want to go through, and I really want to try to see if we can come up with the top two from each block, if you'll indulge me here with this. And let's start with the A block. So I'm going to – I think this is a tough one because I'm going to say Sonata is number one. My first instinct is to say Kiyomiya is number two because he had the whole thing with Okada, and they're in separate blocks here, so they can't really revisit that unless they both advance as part of the top two in the block. But then I wonder, okay, this is a guy from NOAH. Is New Japan really going to have someone from NOAH finish in the top two in the block? And then I look at the rest of the block, and it's like, well, maybe Shota Umino, maybe Hikuleo. Like, it's hard for me to say who would be number two. So I'm going to go Sonata, and I'm going to go Kiyomiya as one and two. So who do you think are your one and two for the A block?
Well, I like the way you think, man, because the one match I wrote and basically built everything around was Okada versus Kiyomiya. And the only way that will come about is one of two scenarios is whether they both win their blocks, because in that case they will be they'll have a chance to meet, or they both are they're both the runner ups on the block. I lean towards them both being the runner up on the block, so I have Sonata or Ren Narita. I'm pulling a Wade Keller pushing. Sonata or Ren Narita, but you can put me down for Sonata against, and then the second one, where is my, and Kiyomiya as the second, as the runner-up.
Okay. All right.
And my thinking, my thinking of that is, my thinking of that is that they're probably going to, because of the Three Musketeers being in that thing, I think that that's going to be a block where nearly everybody is going to be splitting wins and losses, so it's going to be a cluster there near the end, and Kiyomiya is just going to be the one to escape from it. And then the reason I think that Ren Narita might have a chance is because, you know, Sonata just end up getting knocked out because of, like, a time limit draw, or maybe one of the, you know, Three Musketeers beats him to set up a title match in between now and Wrestle Kingdom, that sort of thing. So that was my thinking behind that.
Yeah, I do think Sonata as IWGP Heavyweight Champion, I do think he needs a strong G1 to kind of solidify himself, though. So I have a hard time seeing him being left out of the top two spots. But, you know, I do wonder, like, I know they do the undercard tag matches. Is there a way that Kiyomiya and Okada could be on opposite sides in a tag match, and that's the extent of their interaction on the G1?
Off chance, but I think they'd want to get, because if it does happen, it will be in the either finals or – sorry, it's going to be one of the quarterfinal matches, and I think that's going to be, like, your main event for that night.
The B block seems pretty self-explanatory, unless they just – pull something out of left field. Osprey number one, Okada number two. You know, you look at Kenta, you look at Great Okan. They've had some cups of coffee near the top as pushed acts. They don't really feel hot right now. I don't know. Is there any scenario where you could see someone other than Osprey and or Okada coming out as the number one and number two in whatever order?
No. I was trying to make a case for it because I was looking for the flyer, take a flyer on this guy.
It's hard to even play devil's advocate here.
Yeah, I mean, ever since he left or was kicked out of Bullet Club, El Fantasmo, I don't know where exactly he is, but it kind of seems like they're kind of keeping his comedy-ish gimmick. You know, Tangaloa, you know, is a possibility, but he's coming right off of injury. Great Okan seems like has, you know, they kind of cut the steam off of him. You know, Kenta's not going to be it. Tai Chi, I can see maybe getting a run just so you could push the Five Guys faction. But, yeah, I mean, and Yoshihashi is Yoshihashi, and Yoshihashi disappoints. So, yeah, Okada and Will Ospreay are the only ones that really seem like might be coming out of this. Either, you know, 1-1, 1-2, I have Ospreay as 1 and Okada as 2.
Yeah, same here. Now, I think the C block is when we might diverge a little bit. So I'm going to let you go first on the C block and who you have as number 1 and number 2.
On my breakdown, where's my C1? I have Finley, and I don't really feel strongly about this one, but because there's some people here that I can see get a hard push that I'm not expecting, like an Aaron Hernare, Tamatanga. I can see both of them, and then you always have Evil, and Evil's always a danger. Those three I can see having a shot at it. But the ones I have are David Finley, if you want to establish Bullet Club as an actual serious force, as my winner. And as the runner-up, I have Shingo, because this would set up a Shingo-Sanada match in the first quarterfinal. Or, sorry, in the first, you know, the winner going into the quarterfinals.
I have one of those picks as my final two from the C block. So I was right. We diverge a little bit here. I've got Tama Tonga, number 1, and Dave Finley, number 2. I think, you know, he's a guy who kind of checks a lot of the boxes, and I feel like has had moments where he feels like he's going to be a breakout star in New Japan. And he's had some really solid matches, and I think this is a real opportunity. When you look at the A and B block, it's a lot of, you know, aside from Kiyomiya, who's a special case, you know, Sanada, Okada, and Ospreay are all established veterans in the pecking order of New Japan at the top. You have Finley, who is breaking through into that top spot, as you mentioned, with the Bullet Club. And then I think Tama Tonga is a guy who, by virtue of being in the top two here, can really use this as a springboard to being in that conversation with some of those guys moving forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's why it's also he's on my flyer list with along with Hanare. But I think, you know, Shingo, just because, you know, it gives Sanada an opponent to go over that was part of his former faction, and it's more to strengthen Sanada than anything else. But yeah, I mean, Tama, if Ren Narita is the if scenario where Ren Narita and there are reasons why I have Ren Narita over the other three Musketeers, but one of the three Musketeers goes through, in that case, I think more likely Tama Tonga, who's a more of a veteran, would be, you know, would make sense to be in there with him. But in this case, I'm going with my heart. My number one love is Story, and I think that Sanada and Shingo tell a good story.
So the D block, that's the veteran block, as I mentioned earlier. So who do you have as your number one and number two coming out of this one, Javier?
The number – wait a second. Where's my D1? In this scenario, with Okada and Kiyomura meeting as runner-ups, I have Tanahashi as my number one, and I have Zack Sabre Jr. as my number two. This is the one I'm probably least least sure of.
Yeah, I kind of look at it the same way, and it's interesting the way you've broken it down, because, you know, the winners and the runners-up, because of the bracket out of the blocks, you do have to say, okay, if so-and-so wins this block, then that has a domino effect, and that kind of dictates in your own booking who's going to win the other blocks. And that's much more well thought out than mine, where I'm just looking at the list kind of like, not exactly throwing darts, but I'm kind of like, that sounds like a good name to come out of this. So I'm going to go Sabre number one. So I do think he advances. I'm going to go Naito number two. It's hard to bet against him. I know that he's been kind of phased down a little bit, not to the extent that Tanahashi has. And that's why I don't, you know, used to be, 3-4 years ago when we were doing this, Tanahashi would be an automatic. I mean, he would, you know, you wouldn't even think twice about having him come out of the blocks. And now it just, watching him at Forbidden Door, man, and it just, it's hard for me to see him in the G1 as a realistic contender to come out of it. So maybe that's my own bias, having seen that. But, yeah, I've got Saber and I've got Naito here.
That's what instilled the biggest doubt in me.
Does he even make it through? I mean, that's a legitimate question.
Yeah, I mean, based on my other my other build, I have either the winner of Tanahashi and Naito, and I think that's ultimately the winner of the block is me, the winner between Tanahashi and Naito. That's for sure. The runner up is where I am, more flexible on. But I think that's what, because I am cheating, because on the last night of D block competition, the biggest match there is Tanahashi and Naito.
Yeah, so you're delving further into the booking of the tournament than I am. So when we revisit this in a month or a month and a half or whatever it is, like I'm fully willing to take the L to you, Javier, on this. But yeah, it's going to be interesting.
The curse is when you overthink these things, and when you overthink it, that's when you screw up. So I actually have more faith in you going by your gut than me, thinking about it and then filling in the blanks with my gut. That's
Yes. Paralyzation by analyzation or something like that. You know, you're paralyzed by analysis. Paralysis by analysis. I think that's kind of what we're running into.
Yeah, I play a lot of board games, and the term for that there is analysis paralysis. So
yes, that's what it is. So I will be trying to catch as many. This is the tournament that I really gravitate toward each and every year. I try to catch some live. So if you're someone who's up at 5 a.m. and checking these out, I may be too. I'll try to let you know ahead of time, so you can follow me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks as I'm tweeting along with the shows. But otherwise, we'll do a quick reset here. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, joined by PWTorch.com contributor Javier Machado, and this is Wrestling Night in America for July 9th, 2023. We'd love to hear from you on the topics that we're covering tonight, including the G1 Slammiversary and AEW Collision. You can call us up 515-605-9345 or email us wnialivecast@gmail.com. We'll go to the first phone call this evening. It is from the 410 area code. It is Reverend Keith from Baltimore, Maryland. Reverend Keith, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me, and the two of you have done an excellent job in forecasting and previewing the G1, so I'm going to hold you to some of these predictions. Good job, gentlemen.
Appreciate it, Reverend Keith.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm going to pivot to WWE and focus on how hot the product is right now. I was looking at the stats from SmackDown. It was the highest grossing WWE event to ever take place in Madison Square Garden. And that's amazing when you think about it, because, you know, the late, great Bruno Sammartino was the centerpiece of 84 consecutive dates at Madison Square Garden spanning over 7 years. So that's amazing when you think about it, you know. And I know it's hot. I was ringside this past Monday for Raw, and it was sold out. So WWE is definitely on a roll right now. And it's not just the Bloodline storyline. Of course, I in my opinion, that's the best storyline since Austin McMahon. However, even on the Raw side, you've got the Judgment Day storyline. You've got Seth, you've got Cody and Brock. So how high do you think WWE will go before we enter into 2024?
By what metric are we using to determine hotness?
As far as
okay, well, I mean, same thing. What metric are we using?
Metric as far as ratings, as far as pay-per-view buy rates, as far as sellouts, you know, because these SmackDowns and Raws, no matter where they've been going as of late, have really been selling out. And also, yeah, you know, with the advent of the premium live events being broadcast on Saturdays as opposed to Sundays, and then the fact that they're going to foreign countries, that is helping a lot. So I expect nothing but great numbers. Do you foresee, for example, Raw did a 1-8, and it still struggles that final hour. Do you see Raw getting into the 2.1s, the 2.2s by the end of the year?
I could see that. I don't think it'll happen consistently. I think the trouble is we've got another, you know, month and a half, 2 months until Monday Night Football, and that is going to eat into Monday Night Raw viewership. I think that's really going to be the litmus test of how strong WWE is at the time. And, you know, a month and a half, 2 months is a long time in professional wrestling, so a lot of things could be different business-wise for WWE then when they start butting up against Monday Night Football. But, Javier, that's going to be the litmus test for me to see how much WWE loses viewership to Monday Night Football on Monday versus how much they're able to retain compared to previous years. Because if they're able to maintain a relatively good pace, I think that's going to tell you, you know, there are people choosing WWE over Monday Night Football that normally would have made the inverse decision or the opposite decision. So that's really going to be the metric specifically that I'm looking for to see how sustainable and how hot WWE's product truly is at the time.
Well, yeah, I'm with you on that, and I also want to bring up the fact of the writer strike, because there will become a point where scripted programming is not going to be on the air, so they will not be needing, they would not have that competition either. You know, in terms of, and this is more like also long term, because less things to watch, more likely someone's going to say, hey, look, let me go check out what's going on in wrestling. You know, so WWE is also scripted programming, but you know what I mean.
Right, it's their writers are not covered by the guild.
Yeah, and they're going to be less people going out to see the movies, because there's going to be less movies out there, that sort of thing. There's going to be more entertainment time. You know, people, you know, trying to fill their time with entertainment available for people to watch wrestling, and while it might not make like an impact on the very specific day, I think over a long period of time, you know, just creating more interest in the product and people, you know, falling into it more often and finding it because they've got more time, that also could be a benefit to them.
Reverend Keith, your second question for us tonight.
Moving on to AEW Collision, which is one of your topics for tonight. I thought last night's show was pretty good. Of course, they had to add time to the matches to make up for Willow Nightingale, Ruby Soho's match being delayed a week. So that's why that tag match lasted 28:07. It was a good tag match. It certainly wasn't one of FTR's better matches, in my opinion, but I thought that some of the spots were well done. I thought there was a period of stalling in around the 15-20-minute mark. But it was a good match. I see they've added the 2 out of 3 stip for next week. I don't see the titles changing hands. I really don't. I think the FTR run as tag champs has some legs to it, and I think that they will have them be at the top of the tag team division for a while. And it's good to see that Tony Khan is restructuring the tag division, because as you guys know, for a long period of time, most of your formidable tag teams were being placed in six-man action, like, or trios action, if you will. So now it seems like Tony Khan has placed the tag team division at the forefront to showcase the talent that they are. What are your thoughts on the revitalization of the tag team division in AEW?
I actually wrote a column in the Torch newsletter a few weeks ago about the deficit that I felt was in the tag division partly because, as Reverend Keith noted, a lot of what would be top tag teams were being utilized in the trios division, and that really sucked the pool, not completely dry, but a lot of the top names had moved over to the trios division. And for those who don't know, I do have a full page column in every Torch newsletter. So whether you get the paper copy or the online copy, make sure to check that out. I think that this Bullet Club Gold was a strong match. I kind of cringe every time I hear the term Bullet Club Gold because it reminds me of Global Force Gold, Jeff Jarrett's. I don't know what kind of scheme that was when he was running Global Force, but that's not the image you want to conjure up when you think of one of your top tag teams in the division. I'm also like Juice Robinson's whacked out character. I'm not sure I'm 100% on board with that, but I do like Jay White, and I do like that he's being part of a pushed act here, getting the win over FTR on Collision. So I think that the addition of them is really good move for the tag division. Javier, do you see the tag division on an upswing the same way Reverend Keith does?
Yeah, but not like, you know, I'm not like appointment viewing at this point, but they are taking the necessary steps considering from the nadir that they were on not too long ago. So it definitely has seen improvement. I'm enjoying the guns. I'm enjoying, you know, the stuff they're doing with Bullet Club Gold. It's new stuff that's going on. I am a fan of the, well, okay, let me couch this. I'm a fan of the random tag teams getting put together, the lottery kind of style. I just think that, you know, there are a lot of teams that are like, oh, you know, convenient, you know, I think they've gone too far in that direction, but I do like the, you know, I do think it has improved overall. I'd just like to see, you know, more of it in that direction. And I'd like to see maybe like the Young Bucks at some point get involved in it again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the tag tournament with the kind of lottery that they have with MJF and Adam Cole and some of the other teams, like that's not a way to build the tag division. You know, like you said, it's singles wrestlers kind of thrown together, and the winners get a shot at the tag titles at the end, but it's been really haphazardly done, and it was kind of, it does feel like it was thrown out there solely to build Adam Cole and MJF's feud over the AEW world title, which is an interesting use of getting over the tag division, I think. So I'm definitely kind of in wait-and-see mode. I haven't fully embraced that tournament yet, but we'll have to see. The Cole-MJF hijinks I'm on board with. Everything else I'm kind of rolling my eyes at a little bit right now. Reverend Keith, your third and final point for us or question.
My third and final point is in regards to the main event, Joe Punk 3. Now, I followed these two men dating back to their Ring of Honor days, and this was a knockdown, drag-out brawl, and Samoa Joe proved his mettle. And he doesn't have to. He's like a 20-year veteran. But he really beat down for two-thirds of this match. And it was amazing how Punk got that reverse cradle roll-up in the end. But Joe got his heat back with the Coquina clutch. Now, I'm happy to see Joe getting his flowers because, you know, he was unceremoniously released by WWE. And they kind of, you know, downgraded him to the commentary table. So it's good to see him getting his flowers. I think that they will add those two to either the Ring of Honor pay-per-view or Arthur Ashe or something coming up, you know, maybe All In, but I can't see them dragging that feud out that long. So I think that was a means of getting them to the next level in their feud, Joe and Punk. Now, with Punk and Ricky Starks, I would like to see Starks win because Punk doesn't need to win the Owen. I think it would definitely elevate Starks But after Punk gave that emotional promo prior to the match at the beginning of last night's Collision, one would think that Punk will win. So what are your thoughts on Punk Joe, and what are your thoughts on Punk Starks going into next week's match? Thank you so much for taking my call. You guys have a wonderful week, and may God bless you.
Thank you, Reverend Keith. Same for you, as always. I confess that I was not an early adopter of Ring of Honor. So, you know, Punk Joe does not have the same significance for me that I think it did for a lot of people who lived through that era of ROH and can pick out the callbacks within the match. I'm not the person who, you know, and I'm probably losing a lot of internet wrestling credibility by saying this, but, you know, the use of their ROH theme music that CM Punk has done or that Bryan Danielson has done, and it just pops everybody, I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I come at it from that point of view. But yeah, I thought Joe Punk was fantastic, even in a vacuum, you know, without having sat through their ROH classics, of which I am aware. And I thought they did a nice job for people like me building it in those video packages that aired and the sound bites that aired with Joe and Punk. And then Punk versus Starks, I agree. I don't think Punk needs to win it. And I think, you know, Punk is astute enough student of the game to where I don't think he's going to put his foot down and say, I need to win. I don't, you know, for as much as we talk about ego and things with Punk, I don't think the winning and losing part of it fits into that with him. So I could see him actually wanting to put Starks over in that scenario. Whether Tony Khan agrees, I don't know, because Punk obviously is the biggest star. You're building Collision around him, so you want to give him as many accolades as you can to show that he's worth tuning in to see each and every week. And certainly winning the Owen Cup would do that. Javier, your thoughts on the Joe Punk match from last night and the upcoming Punk Starks match?
Well, okay, let's bring it up. First, the match itself I thought was good. As a matter of fact, I gave CM Punk props because the stuff they did in the match felt like so professional, such a good, you know, it was a straight up good match, right? Selling correctly, you know, a lot of, you know, it's what people, you know, like the people who like more the, or less, you know, are less into the high flying and more about, you know, the more the FTR crowd. This was like that kind of perfect match. As far as that's concerned, that's fine. I actually called in last night because I was so furious with the booking of the match that I was like seeing red. it's mainly because I wasn't like super in tune with ROH at that point. I did see one, if not two, of the trilogy of matches that they had. I believe that they all went, an hour or more. So they were long matches because the storyless matches were like, you know, attrition. That's what I remember about that. My issue with this is that it feels like they were trying to book two things at once. They wanted a match between them at one of the pay-per-views, and at the same time, they wanted Punk to move along in the tournament. And I think the problem was, for me, was that they started telling that story that Punk has never beat Samoa Joe. And the thing is that the way that he won by a roll-up after getting, you know, destroyed for the entire match, and it's essentially a fluke win. So when I saw a headline this morning from, Comic Book News, or it was a comic book site saying that, you know, CM Punk, you know, finally beat Samoa Joe, it doesn't feel like an accomplishment to me story-wise because it was a fluke. He did not beat Samoa Joe. I would much prefer, if you're going to have CM Punk go over Samoa Joe, beat him. You know. See, if you're going to give Samoa Joe his heat back anyway by attacking Punk after the match, you know, why not just have him beat him? That way you have that fulfillment because, in particular, since that's how you were promoting this match. You know, instead, it felt more like Samoa Joe slipping a banana peel, which he actually did at one point in the match where he accidentally slipped. You know, so it felt more that it was like a happenstance kind of thing than, you know, than a culmination of what CM Punk was saying is I need to beat him. So I hated it for that fact. I would have much preferred either if the goal is not for CM Punk to win the whole thing, just have Joe beat him, you know, and tell the but reverse it and have CM Punk destroy Joe, but then Joe wins with a roll up, and then like you say, hey, CM Punk has never beaten Joe, but he came this close. We want to see that match because if you know we feel like if Punk gets one more match against Samoa Joe, we know he's going to beat him, and then you build up the follow up match for the pay per view in that way. So it just felt like they were trying to serve two masters. And ultimately, you're going to just come out more. You're not going to have that extra thing that you need to push the drive to go watch them wrestle again. You know, further than what it could have been. You know, the meaning of the win is lost. You'd lose an opportunity to still have that hanging over Punk's head for a future match. So I thought it was like a really bad decision. So just have either Punk straight up beat him with his finisher, you know, I finally overcame this obstacle, or he loses. That I want to, you know, to protect Joe. I thought that it didn't serve the story, and I don't think it served the future booking of their feud. And in respect, and what this adds worry to me is the case that this is a tournament for Punk to win, because I look at the people there and it's like, okay, Punk. This is a tournament for Punk to win. And now I'm thinking the only way he doesn't beat Starks is if Samoa Joe gets involved and he gets taken out by Samoa, if he gets taken out by Samoa Joe. And to me, whenever you have a tournament, I mean, like first round early, okay, fine. You could have cheating and whatever, but you know, once you're like at that point, you know, at this point in the tournament, like taking out one person from an outside force, if Starks were to win the whole thing, is Starks really the champion of the tournament? No, because he won because the guy who probably would have beaten him was taken out. So, mm-hmm. you know,
at that point, you can't be a babyface and celebrate your win either, because people are going to be like, well, you didn't really earn it. You only got it because Samoa Joe won. So, like, what's – if you're the babyface in that scenario, what's the point of even winning? Like, you can't brag about it because people are going to see through that.
Yeah, so you wouldn't be able, since Starks is his next opponent, Starks at this point, unless Starks just clean beats Punk, Starks cannot win the thing, because if Starks wins via, you know, Punk getting taken out by Joe during the match, you know, either by interference or, you know, however they do that, then Starks cannot win the next round, because if he wins the whole thing, it's meaningless then. It doesn't get him over, because, you know, for that reason. So it'll be somebody else in the tournament to win. So yeah, it's just the I think they're trying to get too cute with their booking, and I think they're starting to Tony Khan's relying way too much on, you know, meaningless wins, roll up wins, distraction finishes, that sort of stuff. You're still getting finishes, unlike so it's not like the match gets called off. But you're not really getting finishes, because you want to see a team beat the other, or a person beat the other. Sorry.
That's a very compelling argument. I hadn't thought about it that way. I'm glad you brought that to light here and the call in last night. Speaking of Collision, that's the second thing I wanted to discuss here tonight. We are 4 weeks into Collision. Had a big drop-off in ratings last week that can be written off as the 4th of July weekend here in the United States. So I think this week is really going to tell the tale. CM Punk in a big singles match. It's off of the holidays, so no more excuse for that. I kind of want to get your thoughts on not just Collision as how it's been, but is it different enough? And I think that's what people were looking for. Give me a reason to tune in. Give me something that isn't just Dynamite light. So in the 4 weeks now, has Collision been different enough from Dynamite, in your opinion, to be a legitimate draw for fans on a Saturday night?
Two questions there. I don't know about a draw on Saturday night is the thing, because it's just the sheer amount of wrestling that is out there, you know. Mm-hmm. But like in terms of like, is it different enough? It's weird because I would have to like watch Dynamite on one TV with Collision running on the other. It feels different to me, but I can't see exactly how, because I think, you know, Dynamite feels like it's drawing some stuff up. I mean, one of the obvious differences is the commentary team, and Kevin Kelly is my favorite commentator. Someone I wish I remember who was, but someone brought up that one of his greatest actually having who he's with, drawing them into the actual story and drawing them into the actual conversation, you know. So instead of the other person that he's with, because in New Japan, when they're touring around Japan, Chris Charlton is usually his color commentator, but Chris Charlton is apparently not allowed out of Tokyo. any venue that they're at that's not like in Tokyo or nearby, Charlton's not there, and he very often brings in a wrestler who wrestles in like the undercard, and you know, and the thing is that he makes them part of the match. He knows the questions to ask them. He knows how to like, you know, get them into the flow of things that are going. Nigel McGuinness, not my favorite commentator. I know a lot of people are like high on him, probably from, you know, the ROH days, but I don't dislike him. He's just like, you know, a meh for me. But you know, with Kelly, it works out well. And I think that to me, I think does have a big influence to it. Also feels like they do a lot better job talking about why we're having the match we're about to see, instead of just saying, hey, look, here's two cool wrestlers that we're going to watch, you know, wrestle now. It feels there's more of that. They started doing it more on Dynamite, which I give them, you know, kudos for, but it does feel like they are spending more time both on promoting the main event throughout the show, because that, you know, instead of just, you know, saying, hey, tonight's main event is this, and then you forget about it, you know, but throughout the show having like, you know, interviews and stuff like that. Feels like I actually like in the format and the stuff, it feels like like what Dynamite should be to me.
Yeah.
You know, so you have that. And then there's also the question of the wrestlers, and these are and there are a lot of wrestlers here I like, you know, and it feels like they're kind of almost a little bit more on their own. It feels like they're more free to do what they're trying to do. So, you know, I'm interested in seeing what's going on with Miro. This is the first time I've actually been interested in anything Andrade's done since he's gotten to AEW, his current feud with him and Malakai Black. Almost the same thing with Malakai Black. I think this might be the first thing I'm interested in whatever Malakai Black is doing. The thing with Powerhouse Hobbs leaving QT Marshall's group. So, yeah, I do like it better. Probably is also on a Saturday, and I'm like, it's going to have to probably be, at some point, it's going to be the thing at DVR. So.
Mm-hmm. I think the reaction that I've seen from people online who say that Collision is like a more a no-nonsense wrestling show, which is weird to say when AEW was kind of built on that. And now, like, I guess people are admitting that Dynamite has kind of drifted from the intention of AEW when it was built, and now Collision is sort of more of the AEW idea of when that company was created. But then you could also argue, well, Rampage is more of a wrestling-centric show. That's a no-nonsense wrestling. It's an hour, and it doesn't have the big names, but that's a wrestling-centric show. Is there really enough room for another one? Or is, you know, Rampage on a Friday night going to be the show that even the diehards start dying off of in favor of Collision? And they say, well, I'm going to go out one night a week. It used to be I'd go out Saturday night because I'd watch Rampage, but now that Rampage and Collision are on the weekends, maybe I'll go out Friday nights and stay in for Collision. I mean, conceivably that could be the opinion of some fans, but I do think it has this, to your point, this almost hard to describe difference, because it's not the wrestling, because Dynamite has a lot of wrestling. Like, it's not like,
well,
Dynamite
is
bereft of wrestling. Yeah.
I think I was able to finally put it in, like, it feels more polished, while the Dynamite feels more rough. You know, it feels like if I'm wandering into Dynamite, I feel like, you know, I'm going to like get my clothes stuck in thorns somewhere, you know? While this one, I feel like it's more of it feels more polished. It feels more smooth to me. You know, that's kind of the way it feels. And I don't know why it is. It's almost like, and it might have to do, just from the commentary, it might have to do with Excalibur, where, you know, Dynamite feels like I'm watching a show that just downed 100 Red Bulls, you know?
Yeah.
So while this just feels, and that actually might just have to a lot more to do with who's doing the commentary. Not that I want to throw Excalibur under the bus, but, you know, he has like an energy which is frenetic, and I think that either Dynamite also has that energy, or has that, or it's like imbued it by Excalibur. While this feels more like, all right, you know, let's take a breath, let's see what's going on, and then, you know, you have your highs, your lows, and it's not all like, you know, it feels like I'm not being screamed at all the time.
Right, which is not a great feeling to have when you're watching a wrestling show. Reverend Keith brought up CM Punk, and not only are we 4 weeks into Collision, we're also 4 weeks into CM Punk's return to AEW after a lot of controversy. How do you view or grade CM Punk's return and how he's been featured as the draw for AEW Collision?
Never been a CM Punk fan. You know, like, that it's just, you know, because the thing is that, like,
it's good to get our biases out there. That's all right to say.
You know, I mean, because they're different things. I've never liked them in terms of, let me phrase that. I liked them well enough in the ring, but not to the point because around the same time, I was more into wrestlers like AJ Styles, Christopher Daniels, and Samoa Joe. There were more the people I had. And I liked CM Punk more as the foil of whoever was going on. I think he was good and all that stuff. I was out of wrestling when he was having his run in the WWE, so I didn't follow his WWE run. I'm not, you know, so it, and then like the AEW stuff happened. I think he's a good orator, you know, captures people's attention on the mic. I think he also knows how to push those really deep, dark buttons those buttons that people have in deep, dark places that will have them fly off the handle and really get to hate them, you know, like just like small comments and stuff, you know, like the unnecessary kind of digs, you know, like from the first time he appeared, he, you know, the young buck, sorry, the counterfeit buck line that he had, you know, that kind of like offhandish thing. And, you know, the whole, you know, tell me I'm telling lies when you're just basically giving a warped perception of what of things that are going on. Yeah, you're not telling lies, but you're also not, you know, you're giving a warped perspective on how you're supposed to feel about those. But yeah, so that's kind of where I come from with Punk. So I'm not like, he is captivating when you listen to him. And so if he's talking, if he has a heel that is just equally as like odious, so you're in with him. I prefer him as a heel because personally, because since I'm already inclined to dislike him, it serves that, from what I've heard, you know, in articles and stuff, he's been behaved and he's taking his response, you know, the idea of being a locker room leader seriously. And, I mentioned this when, I'm not sure it was the first week or right before Collision started, if this is his show and Dynamite is the Young Bucks show and Kenny Omega show and, you know, their show, he has reasons to want to show them up, you know what I mean? And see who does better, between the two of them. So I think that will elevate his game. So far so good. I'm not going to, you know, crap on the dude, and, you know, I'm hoping it works out better, because I mean, if he really does, you know, rebuild his image to the point where, you know, he becomes more of a, you know, people actually want to see him, and you don't have like this divisive audience that are like, you know, upset because they side with the Bucks, and he's able to galvanize everyone around him or everybody against him, that, you know, things could, you know, improve for the company overall, because that's what we ultimately want. We want the company to be successful, because, you know, more successful they are, the, you know, more entertaining product that we get.
Yeah, the Punk report about him minding his P's and Q's backstage, I believe, came from Wade Keller. He had a report on the website for VIP members, so check out what Wade wrote about what the sources are saying backstage in AEW, Punk's first few weeks on Collision. The last thing for Collision before we go to some emails and back to the phones with DJ from Miami, who's waiting patiently on hold, the roster split. There was kind of went back and forth by the day about whether it was going to be a hard split or a soft split. There does seem to be certain wrestlers who are going to be more quote-unquote Collision wrestlers than Dynamite wrestlers. How would you like to see that bear out? Would you prefer a harder split where you know that you can tune into Collision each week and see certain wrestlers if they're your favorites, and tune into Dynamite to see the other half of the roster if you have some favorites there? Or do you like the concept of sort of just kind of floating? It's not a hard split, but, you know, FTR might appear a couple weeks on Collision, then they might appear on Dynamite 1 week. I mean, how would you prefer to see that play out?
Unspoken hard split would be my preference, in which they're, you know, the Malakai Black and Andrade and Miro and CM Punk, they're like your mainstays. That's going to be where FTR maybe, that would be like the, grant that FTR also has the belt, so, you know, they're going to bounce around a little bit more, but, you know, that's going to be the personality of that show. To give it a distinct personality, essentially. But not just say specifically, there's a, you know, these wrestlers are here and these wrestlers are there. That way, if you need to send, Jericho and his crew for a program over the other side, you don't have to make a pomp and circumstance situation of like, oh, yeah, well, you know, there's the one time a year that they could cross over. So, you know, that sort of thing. What I don't really want to see is basically a 15-minute like skit segment to set up a match that then happens on the other show. I don't really want to follow the threads of story across multiple shows. There's a plus and a minus, because if you have thread, you know, you do want to send from one show to the other the people, but you don't also, I don't think you want to make it to a situation where you have to watch both shows, because at that point, if you're only getting half of a story and you don't have time to dedicate 4 hours, and you can only have time to dedicate 2 hours, and you don't, you know, and well, I need to watch 4 hours to know what's going on, well, then in that case, I'm not going to watch, you know, so yeah. That's kind of the thing. That's the thing. When you're talking about this kind of situation, you basically do have to get into a situation where you're like, you're juggling both. You're gonna have to juggle both and see, you know, where it's gonna lie. And I personally don't like, because this is what essentially killed the comic industry is, you know, you start catering more and more to the hardcore fans that are going to watch the 4 hours. But the thing is that, you know, I'd rather have two people watching the 2 hours, you know, two people, one watching 2 hours of Dynamite, one watching 2 hours of Collision, than having one person watching 4 hours. Because if you lose that one person, you lost 4 hours. If you lose, you know, one of the other two, you're only losing 2 hours.
Yeah, I made the argument the last time I was on the flagship with Wade. I thought it should have been a hard split, and he sort of pushed back a little bit, wondering if AEW had a deep enough roster to be able to pull that off. I kind of think they do. But, yeah, I mean, you're going to have your champions that are going to have to float, so that's going to help the depth of both shows, because the champions are ideally going to be some of your stronger wrestlers, and if one show is perceived as weaker in terms of depth, then if you have the champions appear more often on those shows, it will appear stronger. So I think there are some ways to mask that, even if you don't believe that AEW has the depth to have a hard split. But yeah, so that's kind of my thought on it. I want to get to the mailbag. We have Azan, who has sent in, this is, I'm going back deep into the mailbag for this one because I missed a couple weeks there at the beginning of June when Azan sent a couple of these in. So we'll get to one next week, hopefully the next one next week. He's got three questions for us. He says, hello, PWT crew. Number one, when would you do the match between Takeshita and Omega? Good question. I mean, obviously they're building to that. Don Callis now managing Takeshita after being a lifelong friend of Kenny Omega and managing his career. So that does seem to be the build. You know, you've got a big London show coming up. Do you do it then? Do you do it at the, you know, the pay-per-view coming up? Do you do that? You know, I don't know. I mean, do you do it All Out? Those are the two, and maybe I'm accelerating it too much. I mean, maybe we're not even going to get to it then. Maybe it's in November. But those are, to me, the three big signposts up ahead for AEW that you could argue Takeshita and Omega. I don't know. I don't have a preference or a real feel for it, Javier. Do you have a feeling of when... which one of those shows you feel would be best to unleash Takeshita versus Omega to the world?
Probably All In or All Out. I'm not sure how they're going to end up doing those two since they're a week apart, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I have no idea how they're going to end up booking those two things with only 1 week in between. You know, because like if this were like a New Japan kind of situation, I would almost expect All In be nothing but like tag matches to preview your upcoming pay-per-view kind of thing. So I would think most likely All In or All Out. I mean, Kenny Omega all but said that, I mean, unless it's a tease and unless it's a swerve, and if it's a swerve, it's a horrible idea to do a swerve with this, Kota Ibushi is coming in. He said, I think it was a post-match, like, you know, while the, you know, after the show was over, you know, that, you know, he had gone out and gotten someone. So it's likely that the fifth member is going to be, the fifth member of the team is, I'm thinking, likely be Kota Ibushi. And then, you know, so All In, you could have, you know, the Golden Lovers, Kota Ibushi and Omega versus, Konosuke and maybe Jericho if Jericho ends up joining them, and then, you know, have a singles match on the following week, maybe something like that.
Yeah, I wonder if they do it. I mean, this is kind of getting a little off topic, but I wonder if they do it like a two-night WrestleMania, or if they try to load up and have, you know, multiple big matches. I mean, you almost have to do multiple big matches,
yeah,
with multiple big wrestlers because it's not in the same city, you know, it's very different. So
yeah.
The ticket buying public is not going to want to say, you know, oh, Kenny Omega wrestled on England. That means he's not wrestling at All Out. So I think there's going to be some frustration there. So you can't really do it like a two night WrestleMania event, I guess, that way.
Yeah. I mean, you could still have like, you know, like, I mean, that would be the best case scenario, is having the Golden Lovers versus Takeshita and somebody else from that family. And then, you know, the following week would be, you know, the singles match. So you get the top guys twice, but yeah, the lower cards you don't have to have the North Atlantic Treaty Organization title. What did they start calling that? I like that now.
The international title?
Yeah, the international title. Yeah, you know, you don't have to have the international title on both shows. But you probably do want to have Orange Cassidy on both shows, or maybe have him in a four-way, you know, or a four-on-four tag team, you know, and in 1 week, and, you know, have in the undercard, but then have him, you know, in the other. So you could play with that, but yeah, I mean, it's going to be. I'm really fascinated by how they're going to book themselves out of that mess.
Question number two from Azan. Can you see Johnny Gargano facing Seth Rollins on Raw, and what do you think his WWE outlook is after a year since his return? I don't think Gargano, just based on his booking, is high on the list of facing Seth Rollins, especially now that they're both baby faces. And I know Seth is sort of taking on all comers as champion, but I don't feel like Gargano is being pushed to that level. It does seem like he's going to reform the way or potentially even reform a partnership with Ciampa. So I don't see Rollins versus Gargano in the cards, at least in the short term, Javier. What do you see happening there?
Yeah, I think that the stuff with Gargano and the way, so Candice LeRae, indie wrestling, and Tommaso Ciampa, I think that's part of the, because I keep hearing about Triple H's plan, and that, you know, we'll see his plan, come to start after WrestleMania. And then that got pushed back. And then, you know, Vince is back. So now it really seems that aspect of his plan, which I think that the way in Gargano and those guys were going to be high up on there. I have a feeling that that's been put more on hold because of the interference from Vince McMahon. So that's why I don't see that happening in the near future until, you know, Triple H is able to actually have real control.
Yeah, and who knows when that's going to be.
Yeah.
And the third question, how many matches can you get out of the Bloodline story now, and can you see Heyman and Solo turning on Roman when he loses the belt? Oh, I think they can get a lot of matches out of the Bloodline. I think we saw the tag match. We're going to see a singles match probably at SummerSlam. Jay and Roman Reigns. I mean, you still got Jimmy and Roman Reigns. You've got Jimmy and or Jay against Solo Sikoa. You have potentially way down the line Solo Sikoa and Roman Reigns. So, you know, they could build 6 months out of just the Bloodline infighting, I really think, especially with Roman not appearing on every SmackDown, not appearing on every PLE. You could certainly do that. Heyman and Solo turning on Roman when he loses the belt is an interesting concept. If the long-term goal here is to turn Roman Reigns babyface and you wanted to make a star out of someone new in Solo Sikoa, I think that's a really interesting way to do it. But again, we're talking way down the line, and a lot of things can change between now and then. What do you think about those two things, Javier?
It does feel a little bit like the Bloodline stuff might have accelerated a bit, which makes me think, hey, did they finally land the Rock? you know, for like maybe Survivor Series kind of, you know, time period. Because, I mean, it feels like, you know, he's losing control. I can totally see the elders send someone to try to reestablish control, and that'd be the Rock, you know, that kind of, you know, storyline. But you know, if that ends up, and you know, if they finally were able to get it, but let's say, you know, not, it does feel accelerated. I think that the words that are the same, Reigns ends at WrestleMania would probably be my guess, and I think that at that point is when Solo, it would make sense for Solo to turn on him. And I do like the idea of Heyman, you know, taking Solo, you know, after, it almost feels like the storyline, because I mean the whole storyline of Don Callis and Kenny Omega, which they started hinting at, but I think it kind of got derailed, might have been derailed because of the brawl out thing, the whole idea behind the Don Callis thing is that Don Callis just moved on to a new model because Kenny Omega, he already you know, spent Kenny Omega. That's basically what it feels like, what Paul Heyman is doing, that he's spending Roman Reigns, and then now he's going to, you know, once things come to a head, that, yeah, Solo takes, you know, so I mean, not really take over the Bloodline, because at that point there's no Bloodline to take over, but essentially, you know, be the one to bring down Roman Reigns.
Mm-hmm.
By bring down, I mean win the title, but, you know, after he wins the title,
yes,
he takes him out, yeah, for a period of time, and then buy some time, you know, for people to start missing him, and then he comes back as a babyface.
Let's go to the phones. DJ from Miami is on. DJ, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first question for us tonight?
I wanted to go back to the Punk thing, what you guys are talking about. I want to know what's in that bag. Y'all know what's in that bag? I don't know what's in that bag. I mean, could it be a bat or a barbed wire? I don't know. Could it be anything? Could it be a dog? I don't know. But You know what I'm saying?
Probably not the dog. I hope not anyway.
At the end of the day, I feel like, I don't know, at the end of the day, I like how they're saying, like, Joe never beat him. I mean, he never beat Joe, and I like how that they keep on saying that, like, oh, leading up at the end of the day, I don't think they're going to do anything for a while. I think they'll do the MJF thing, and then after that, maybe Joe will come up, because we all know Joe. Joe will get hurt or something will happen, because I feel like Adam Cole might turn heel. So I don't know what's going to do at the end of the day, because what's going to happen if Adam turns heel, and then we have MJF and then Joe as heel. What? Okay, buddy. And then just Punk. Will thought Punk was going to turn, what, babyface? Or we don't know what he is. So, and then today, what do y'all think is in that bag? And what do you think was going to happen the day with Joe and him?
I think it's the old title that Punk had that was in the bag. And I think he's kind of carrying that around, waiting for the right moment to spring it on MJF. I don't think Adam Cole is going to turn heel. He just turned babyface when he returned from injury. So I think that would be way too quick to turn him back heel. But, you know, Javier, Punk versus Joe, I know we talked at length about, you know, that situation playing a part in Punk versus Starks in the Owen Hart tournament, but is that something you could see them kind of holding off on further down the line, as DJ suggests?
Punk versus Joe?
Yeah.
No, I think Punk versus Joe is just like the first feud for CM Punk to get his feet wet. Them teasing Jay White and CM Punk, I think, is really what the big match between for Collision is going to be, Punk and Jay White. And at that point, that's the one reason why I think that, because I do agree that Punk doesn't necessarily need to win the 0-4 himself, but I think he does need to win it for Collision, because if he wins the 0-4 Collision and that comes, you know, I'm not going to say it's coming with necessarily his own belt, its own championship, but if he becomes a top guy at that point, maybe he does show that, hey, look, you know, what's in here is the title. Then you have two titles, you know, him defending, you know, his on Collision, MJF defending the other one on there, eventually leading to them having a ladder match with, you know, over the two titles, like, you know, Tony really likes to do. he's repeated that storyline, twice now of the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon storyline. But, mm-hmm. You know, I personally hope there's some sort of swerve that maybe that whatever – I mean, it sounded metallic, I think, but, you know, whatever's in there might be like a swerve and not being – because we're meant to think it's the title, it's his title. But maybe it ends up being a swerve. Who knows?
All right. DJ, the second question for us tonight.
I just got real quick, though. I think that if they have the ROH title, whatever title it is, I think Joe will win that. Because I think that they have other things going with him. So at the end of the day, I don't know. I think they should really hold off, because I think everybody wants to see that, and that will be a money match. So you know what I mean? And the Adam Cole thing, this is why I say he's going to go heel. Because how he's acting with, and he's always buddy-buddy with MJF, I'm telling you, he might turn heel, because how he was acting, like, hey, Roddy, be okay. It's okay. Like, and MJF's like, yeah, whatever. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like at the end of the day, something might happen. He might turn swerve. Because we all know he's better as a heel anyways. So my second question is, this is great. Of all things, why Spears and Cage? Like, of all people, come on. And then the dinosaur, this is bad and horrible. Just when Spears is coming back, like, I don't understand. Where are they going to go with Spears? And why is he back doing this? He could have done anything else.
I think AEW must think more highly of Sean Spears than you do. I think the real attraction here, Javier, for me, is Christian Cage's performance as manager and de facto champion of Luchasaurus's belt that he won. But you know, I look, this is a TV match. I don't think it's not Sean Spears, you know, getting a big pay-per-view main event again. You know, it's nothing like that. Like, it's a short-term thing, so I don't see a lot of harm in it. I mean, Javier, where do you see Sean Spears kind of fitting into AEW? I think he's a guy who would probably be better off on Collision. Collision could be used as a fresh start for a lot of guys, and that kind of feels like what Spears needs.
Yeah, I mean, he just needs to be a gatekeeper. You know, that's kind of – and this is just going to be a quick thing to get Luchasaurus a win in a title defense. You know, if this does go further, then we'll revisit it then. But, I mean, you know, the thing about Spears is I know Spears can be good because Spears made – you know, don't forget, like – Spears and Cody was actually a match we were looking forward to at one point in AEW.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Spears. And remember, that was like one of the special things about AEW. It's like, wow, this is Ty Dillinger. We're actually looking forward to, you know, him. It the wheels came off after that, but hey, maybe we get half of that, you know, might be fun, but you know, just a win. That's really what that's all for. Just to touch on the Adam Cole thing, I get what you're saying. I don't think it's like a full heel turn, but I do think we're going to see Adam Cole like basically doing, you know, not nice stuff because he's with MJF. It's not going to be a full heel turn. It's going to be like a situation where like, wait a minute, you know, at some point it's like, what am I doing? And then, you know, go back into being a babyface. But I think he's going to be doing some he's going to get into some shenanigans with MJF because MJF is going to be like a bad influence on him.
It does feel like two guys trying to outsmart each other. Like MJF saying, oh, you know, Adam Cole thinks I'm his friend, but I'm not, and I'm going to turn on him. And Adam Cole's like, oh, MJF thinks I'm buying this act, but I'm not, and I'm going to turn. So it's like, who's going to turn on the other first is kind of like the question that I think every fan watching is going to see because they're both trying to swerve each other. DJ, your third and final question for us tonight.
Okay, my final question is, oh, boy. Jim Cornette was saying that Waller was a jobber and he shouldn't be doing anything with John Cena. John Cena should be doing something with Braun Breaker or somebody higher up in the food chain or blah, blah, blah. At that day, where do you really see Waller? I mean, do you think that is it going to go good? Do you think he should be doing something else and not wait for John Cena? Do you think he should be, you know what I'm saying? I don't know at the end of the day with him. I mean, he has a show. Everybody has a show. It's, you know, I don't know. That hurts everybody who, you know, everybody has a show. But I'd rather him show his wrestling skills, not talk on the mic, you know, have a show, but show his mic skills, but not have a show. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think for Grayson Waller and I, you'll be the first to admit, longtime listeners of this show know that I have not really bought into the Grayson Waller hype for a while. I do think he's more palatable, his act anyway, on the main roster so far. So I like what I've seen out of him there. And I made the point in my roundtable for Money in the Bank, and I've seen a lot of people make similar points, that Grayson Waller seems to be doing the Austin Theory act better than Austin Theory does. And I think that comparison was just deepened by the interaction with Cena. I mean, you compare Austin Theory's interaction with Cena to Grayson Waller's, and they're very similar characters, and it's going to draw and invite those comparisons. So, you know, I don't think it was a mistake to have Grayson Waller interact with Cena. You want to use whatever rub Cena has as a generational top star to give to younger talent who can say, hey, I rubbed elbows with Cena, and it's a way for fans to know that WWE takes this guy seriously if they're going to spend some of John Cena's very rare television time on wrestling to interact with this person. So I got to say I've got no problem with that interaction or the Waller act as it stands right now, Javier.
Do you remember the last time I was on with you? It was one of the NXT shows. I had not been watching NXT. And if you remember, one of the things that stood out to me, I told you, was Grayson Waller. that it felt like he had natural control of the mic, and that was a big deal, and so he stood out to me. And weirdly enough, that was the best Grayson Waller show I saw, because this stuff feels like it's overly WWE scripted, same BS that we always get. It felt different than the one I saw in NXT, which makes me think that, you know, writer involvement. I think Grayson Waller, I mean, you need to build the future of, you need to build the future for WWE. And, you know, so Waller's one of them, Theory's another, you know, we're talking about Cena, but it's not just Cena. He got the rub from Edge. He had his first match against Edge, and he had a good match with him. And, you know, and story-wise, he took Edge to his limit, and Edge at the end gave him the rub by saying, "You swam," because he had said, you know, "It's time to swim, Junior." And he said at the end, even though Edge beat him, he gave him back, some shine by saying, you swam. And that is WWE telling you, pay attention to this dude, because we're going to get behind him. Austin Theory, Austin Theory's still young, and it's going to take, you know, sometimes it snaps quickly, sometimes it takes a longer period of time, but that's what you need to do. And, you know, you got some people you're probably someone just got kicked out of NXT, so we're probably going to see him in WWE. Who was it? Was it the Creed?
Yeah, loser leaves NXT. Yeah, the Creeds.
Yeah, so likely we're going to see them. So we're going to start seeing some younger people that are going to, you know, and they're going to be the future going on, because, you know, you can't continue, relying on Sheamus.
Good point there. DJ, thank you for the phone call this week.
Hey, one thing real quick.
Go ahead.
Okay. I wish it was shorter, okay? If it was shorter, he went off left field a little and was a little long, okay? Then also, when he went to do the thing with him, I feel like John Cena should just clothesline, boom, he should have powdered out of the ring compared to, like, John giving him the thing, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that would have been so much better. And then he just walked away like, of course John has to do the thing. You know what I'm saying? I would have loved that so much better.
All right, duly noted. Thank you, DJ. All right, real quick before we go, we'll have one more email, and we'll talk a little bit about Slammiversary. I was pleasantly surprised, Javier, when you sent me the DM saying that you were watching Impact so we could talk about this. I appreciate that. I don't have a lot of guests who have that in their arsenal. So, as I mentioned, Slammiversary is also on the 15th, the same day that the G1 begins. I believe that is next Saturday. And so the lineup for Slammiversary is Alex Shelley versus Nick Aldis for the Impact title, Deonna Purrazzo versus Trinity for the Knockouts Championship, Bully Ray and Steve Macklin versus PCO and Scott D'Amore, Ace Austin and Chris Bay versus Brian Myers and Moose versus Rich Swann and Sammy Callahan versus Subculture for the tag titles in a four-way, Angels versus Jonathan Gresham versus Kevin Knight versus Kushida versus Mike Bailey in an Ultimate X Division number one contenders match, Chris Sabin versus Leo Rush for the X Division Championship, Taylor Wilde and Kylan King versus Killer Kelly and Masha Slamovich for the Knockouts Tag Titles, and Eddie Edwards versus Kazarian in a singles match. Just overall, what jumps out to you most about that card?
One of the things is poor Steve Macklin's snake bit, because it looks like he's going to be missing the car because he was injured in their Australia tour. So Bully Ray will be announcing his tag team partner tomorrow on Busted Open. So we'll find out and there's also a question of whether PCO is still intact after he was set on fire by Bully Ray.
Not only that, but was made to drink battery acid.
Yes. So you have that. It's the payoff of a couple storylines. One of the big storylines I have been telling is was the aforementioned Steve Macklin and Bully Ray having problems with Scott D'Amore's authority, and Scott D'Amore basically took a leave of absence as vice president of Impact so that he could get revenge on these two people. They put him through a flaming table. You have that. You have Trinity finally fighting for the actual title. So, you know, she, you know, was big news when she joined Impact, and then Deonna Purrazzo was defending her title against Jordynne Grace. Trinity said, "I've got next." So now, you know, it's time for next. I mean, assuming Deonna Purrazzo still has the title because she's putting it up on the line in an open challenge on next Impact show. So I'm assuming Deonna's probably going to, you know, retain. But, you know, I mean, I really enjoy the Killer Kelly character. She has this it's almost she gets turned on by violence. And so she has currently teamed up. She had it all. Against All Odds, Killer Kelly and Masha Slamovich were feuding, and they blew it off with a dog collar match that Masha won. But they had so much fun. Masha had so much fun having a fight with her that when Killer Kelly got attacked by the Coven, Masha, you know, came in to make the save, and you know, they basically, and then later on, Killer Kelly played the favor, leading to this tag team match for the women's tag team title, and it was, you know, and they basically they consummated their partnership by locking each other again with a dog collar, and I love the commentary saying that instead of them, you know, being linked together, you know, to fight, they're linked together as partners. So I thought that was really neat. There is definitely like a bondage kind of, you know, kink thing going on in this storyline. You know, witches and chains and people getting, you know, there's definitely a vibe on this. So yeah, I mean, you know, then you have Alex Shelley, you know, who beats Steve Macklin, because Alex Shelley, you know, he's, you know, part of the story being that Alex Shelley has coached a lot of people. The big name that, you know, he kept repeating was Seth Rollins. That Seth Rollins comes from part of his learning tree. So, you know, so Alex Shelley saying that he's, you know, he's given so much, and then he's never won the world champion, and then he finally beat Steve Macklin to win it, and now, you know, Nick Aldis shows his true colors, and they got into that. And the other, and then spinning off of this was Sabin, who was the X Division champion, got attacked while he was making the save on Alex Shelley when Nick attacked him. He got attacked by Leo Rush because for some unfathomable reason, well, probably not unfathomable because it is Impact. Impact apparently exists in a reverse dimension where wrestlers who are heels everywhere else on the planet are babyfaces on Impact. And baby faces everywhere else on the planet, like Leo Rush, who's a member of Chaos, is a heel now in Impact. So there's some sort of weird, like, you know, it's almost like Impact exists in the mirror universe in Star Trek. And then there's a couple other matches, but those are usually just let's put in a bunch of X Division people together and a bunch of tag teams together just so that we can, you know, get a lot of people on the card, you know, without much story there. Oh, and Joe Hendry, and my favorite Joe Hendry defends his digital media.
The digital media?
Yeah, championship against the former stripper, Kenny King, as he made a song for Kenny King where he said that he disappeared in 2013, and he did some research and found out that he became a stripper. Because I think Kenny King also mentioned it on Renee's podcast, because that was part of the song. And so people have been walking up to Kenny King on the street, and women's been walking up to him and then putting money down his pants. So some funny skits there. So I thoroughly enjoy the humor of the of Joe Hendry. So
one of Azan's questions that he emailed in that I was going to save for next week was your thoughts on Alex Shelley as Impact Champion, and he won the title a couple weeks ago over Steve Macklin. Which seems like, you know, pretty smart timing now with the Macklin injury that's going to put him on the shelf. But there is a sense that someone like Alex Shelley, who's largely been an X Division or tag team wrestler, wildly successful in those two endeavors, but a longtime Impact resident getting the title at this point in their career can kind of seem like a, you know, just a thank you instead of something that they feel like they fans feel like they earned. Do you feel like Alex Shelley is, you know, Impact Championship worthy at this stage of his career, or does this feel like kind of a memento, a thank you from Impact for the work that he's put in over his career in the company?
Both.
Yeah.
Both can be true. The thing is that essentially the storyline, Impact has been hit by some unfortunate timed injuries. Oh my God, who was the champion? my memory sucks.
Josh Alexander.
Josh Alexander, there you go. And it was Alexander, just because you remember. So yeah, Josh Alexander, he was, I believe, the longest reigning Impact champion. And while that was going on, they were telling the story with Steve Maclin that he basically was beating everybody, every single babyface on the roster, including and some heels too, because I think he also feuded with Moose. So he was beating everybody that Alexander was beating. Maclin was coming up and beating behind them. So they were telling this long-term story, setting up a match between the two. And then, you know, the match is finally booked. And then that's when Josh Alexander has his, I think, tore his shoulder. And then he's gone for a year. So that story never paid out. So it went to the title went to Maclin, which I thought was going to go to anyway. But I think that they have now pivoted to the because when Impact and you know a lot of the indies when you know things go awry with like the big star that you bring in and you don't have someone you give it to your true stayed person when Tessa Blanchard you know I think it was when Tessa yeah I think it was Tessa Blanchard when she you know the COVID stuff started and you know I know part of it wasn't totally her fault but you know part of it was. You know, they didn't really have the, you know, they never finished that storyline, but then, so they, you give it to somebody who's your, like, the one that is like the one that everyone likes in the company. And at that point it was Eddie Edwards. I think that's the point of giving it to Shelley is because whatever they were going to planning on doing didn't pan out. You're giving it to Shelley. It's a feel good story. He's not going to be like, you know, the story, you know, the big story, but it's, you know, it is like a thank you for your hard work and all that stuff. And on the last episode, I think they might have played their hand because I think Ray Walt, I'm pretty sure it was Ray Walt, mentioned on commentary that there's always option C. Chris Sabin is the current champion. And I, you know, I could see the you know Chris Sabin going for option C in order to. You know, say, hey, look, you know, we're the Motor City Machine Guns. They're, by the way, the people who don't know, Alex Shelley and Chris Sabin are Motor City Machine Guns tag team. He could be like, hey, you know, what, you know, he could turn it in cash option C, which is basically kind of like Money in the Bank that you get a title shot against the Impact World Champion. And I can see it be like, hey, look, you know, we both have the championships. What is a better honor than the two of us fight against each other in the main event of a show? So I could see that be a, you know, part of a storyline also going on from there.
Oh, I definitely saw that when they came out a couple weeks ago on Impact and were doing the promo to start the show. And I was like, wait a minute. One is Impact champion. One is the X Division champion. I think I know how this story goes by now. And so, yeah that was, it seems like the direction they're going with that. And again, that is next Saturday, so we'll talk about it next week. The results on Wrestling Night in America next Sunday night. Javier, I want to finish tonight with an email from John from a couple weeks back. I didn't get a chance to get to because of my vacation. He says, hi, Greg and co-host. Hope you're both doing well and that you had a great vacation, Greg. I did. Thank you, John. His first question, going with or against crowd reactions? Since WrestleMania especially, it has seemed quite noticeable that talent like Rhea Ripley and LA Knight have increasingly been getting cheered by crowds, but they remain heel. There is no one right way to tell stories, and if they have stories planned that have a specific cadence, maybe they shouldn't do a turn just based on crowd reactions. However, I have generally been of the belief that the crowd should dictate how talents are booked within reason the majority of the time, because if crowds are consistently passionate for someone, I believe you should be flexible in your booking and give the fans what they want instead of giving off the perception that you're fighting them. especially after what happened with Roman Reigns as a babyface all those years ago and the stubbornness in not turning him sooner. I believe Rhea especially could be a face of the company, and I feel she's being held back from her peak potential and not facing top challengers for her title currently, while Dominic Mysterio gets monstrous boos and Finn Balor and Damian Priest mix it in with the main event scene with Seth for the World Heavyweight title. It could be jarring for Rhea to suddenly turn, but if they do it in the next month to 6 weeks, maybe even at SummerSlam, she could be one of the biggest baby faces ever. Whatever it is, she has it. Just let fans embrace her as a baby face at the right time. Question. What do you think about going with crowd reactions when writing your shows, and should you turn someone if, say, after 2 or 3 months, a talent consistently gets cheered or booed everywhere? So, Javier, my take on this is, it depends. It's a case-by-case basis. For example, Rhea Ripley. They probably have long-term plans for her as a heel champion. I say let those run its course. Even if she is getting some cheers, there's nothing that I see with her that would dissipate. I don't think that when they do decide to turn her, whenever that is, hopefully not anytime soon, that all of a sudden the fans will be tired of her. I don't see that happening. So I think in the same way that, you know, we sometimes argue, and we did it with Roman Reigns way back when, that the best way to make someone is a really good babyface, and you're seeing that with Jack Perry too, is to turn them heel. Let them be a heel first, make fans want to see them as a babyface, and then they'll accept them even more as a babyface. So I think Rhea Ripley is on that trajectory. But, you know, as a champion, I'm sure that WWE, or at least hopefully, they have some intricately booked stuff planned out for her over the next few months, and I don't think they should turn it on its head just to turn her babyface because a pocket of fans are cheering her. Now, on the other end of that spectrum is LA Knight, who is an undercard guy. It's obvious WWE doesn't have any real plans for him. Does it really matter in the grand scheme of things if he is a heel or babyface? Probably not. So why not take the chance, turn him babyface, and really see what he can do as a babyface? Again, I think they're in different situations, which is why my answer is different for them. I don't think there's one blanket right way to do it. But what's your take on that? You know, if you are Booker, Javier, and you see the fans reacting differently to someone than the way you have them booked, I mean, is your instinct to try to more align them with what the crowd wants, or how do you view that?
Yeah, I mean, this is like something I'd like to have an in-depth talk about, for a bit, because part of the thing is that because it's just with, you know, my take on things is that it's really hard right now to get like a true heel that gets booed in the way that, for example, like Dominic does, how MJF had been for a while, you know, or American Top Team. Mm-hmm. What's his name? The coach
that was on Impact for a bit. You could just say America Top Team. I think we know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So those kind of people, or you know, Don Callis. You know, it's kind of hard, but you know, because there are a lot of baby faces where you'll see Roman Reigns being a perfect example. Roman Reigns comes out, says, "Acknowledge me." The crowd goes wild. Everybody goes wild. Everyone puts their fingers up in the sky. You know, everybody's like on board with him. But the moment the drama starts between him and Jay, they start booing him, and they start playing along. So, you know, so the question is, Rhea Ripley, is it that we're cheering her because we like her, but then when we put her up against a babyface we like, we're going to boo her? The thing is that right now I haven't seen that. So, like, until we see her face-to-face with Becky, for example, I don't know, you know, we're not going to be able to know. So, like, maybe if, you know, put in front of Becky Lynch, you know, people will cheer her when she comes out, but once the match starts and she starts putting her promos, they will boo her because they're going along with the story, right? Mm-hmm. The other side of the question is, like, if her next opponent is, for example, Raquel Rodriguez, right? I think that hurts Raquel Rodriguez because I think Rhea Ripley is both more popular and more liked. And they're going to, and I don't think Raquel Rodriguez is a strong babyface. So I think they're going to crap all over her and do damage to Raquel Rodriguez. So I think it really depends on your situation. I wouldn't really put Rhea Ripley against a strong, a weak babyface. If you're going to put her up against somebody, put her against a strong babyface. Like, I wouldn't put her today. I wouldn't put her up against Bianca Belair, because I think that might actually end up hurting Bianca Belair. But like, and I wouldn't put her up against Raquel, and I wouldn't put her up maybe a Liv, because people like Liv for other reasons. But you know, have her put her, you know, put her up against, like, you know, I think Becky would still get cheered over Rhea Ripley, maybe, because Becky's also in a weird place too. But you know, that's kind of overall my generalized feelings about it.
Dan Lambert was the American Top Team.
Yes, thank you.
Ahead, and
thank you.
I knew it was Dan. I knew it was Dan something. I just couldn't remember. He's been out of my mind for so long. A couple more parts to John's email here. His other topic is on the weekly world title open challenges. With Seth Rollins defending regularly and issuing open challenges, it reminded me of John Cena and his weekly U.S. open challenges in 2014-2015 and how much I enjoyed them. It was arguably the best run of his career. Some people are of the belief that you cannot do that with a world title every week, or it loses its value if just anyone can get a shot as long as they answer an open challenge. But I have some counterpoints to that. First, be very strategic about each and every person who answers the challenge. Don't let guys like Akira Tozawa or one of the former Maximum Male Models answer the challenge. I believe if Seth or another babyface champion faces credible challengers and has serious matches, it will boost the prestige of the title. Second, Seth said he wants to be fighting champion and essentially the opposite of Roman Reigns. You need to differentiate his title reign with that of Roman's and having serious mat classics every week, or you could do angles instead some weeks like this past week, could be that. Thirdly, it adds stakes to all his weekly matches, and one thing for years WWE has struggled is with making matches feel very important. Now, a title defense isn't the only way to add stakes, but I think it goes well with my other reasons. Finally, if WWE puts all their promotional weight behind each and every open challenge while still allowing Seth to engage in feuds with other people simultaneously, his feud opponents for PLEs can be at ringside or try to interfere or attack Seth before or after some open challenge matches, fans should undoubtedly care for the variety in his reign and differentiation in open challenge and PLE feuds. Question, do you believe it's impossible to do a weekly world title open challenge and it be successful in the long run? I like the idea of open challenges, but I think doing it for the U.S. title level is perfect because you can get guys of all stripes, of all shapes and sizes to come and answer the challenge. I think the weekly world title, and John's first point was don't have kind of the riffraff challenge. I think that's kind of the point, though, of having an open challenge. It's allowing those wrestlers who would never normally get an opportunity at the title to get that opportunity, and that is the Akira Tozawas of the world. That is the Massey and Mansoors of the world. I mean, in theory, the psychology behind it would be that. You know, it would be guys who would not normally have that opportunity, which is why I think it's better for a U.S. title level, because it's not such a leap to have, you know, a Chad Gable or an Otis or I hate that I keep using him as an example, but a Tozawa. It's more reasonable to have Tozawa answer a U.S. title open challenge than to have him answer a world title open challenge, even though the psychology is the same. So you could have lesser guys challenge for the U.S. title. You could have guys above the U.S. title, main eventers, challenge for it. You could have guys of all stripes challenge for it. So I like it better for the intermediate title than I would for the world title. What do you think about the concept and execution open challenges? Yay or nay?
Well, to the Seth Rollins thing specifically, he does not have the world title. He has the world title runner-up. So that's why I will view it a little bit more like the – I view it more like the U.S. title than I do – you know, because the real title right now is Roman Reigns. So that's why I view that title more as the runner-up. I do like that. I think that if in the case of the world title that Reigns has, that the people, it's not the low card people, but the, you know, like if you were to divide the roster into upper, middle, low, the middle being like where your U.S. intercontinental type guys would be, like your Sheamus, although Sheamus has wrestled for the, you know, the has held the championship, the big title. A lot of people have because, you know, those titles tend to go around a lot. But, you know, the people on that level, they should, you know, those should be the ones answering the open title. Some of the lower upper card ones that you are not planning on putting into a program with your champion, I think, you know, not the low card people. If you have an open challenge with the U.S. title, in that case, yeah, the people from the lower mid and lower card. Like the Tozawa's good challenge for the U.S. But yes, but you could open it up for like the mid card titles, like, you know, Miz. But, you know, obviously Miz has been champion. That's why it's kind of hard. You know, like the Ciampa's. Ciampa would be a mid card guy, and he was supposed to challenge for the actual. He was actually supposed to challenge Seth Rollins until plans were changed at the last minute. You know, Gargano. You know, Gargano would be one because we brought that up earlier. You know. I wouldn't put Dexter Lumis. Dexter Lumis would answer a U.S. Open challenge, not a top challenge. But, you know, it serves a purpose, particularly since you're talking about a three-hour show. If your title match is coming in, you know, in the third hour, maybe it retains viewership too.
So a couple more questions from John. This piggybacks off his previous one. He says, I also believe if not Seth and the World Heavyweight title being involved in weekly open challenges, then Gunther could be that guy as the Intercontinental Champion. He already is called the Ring General and is a top-notch worker who has tremendous pride in being Intercontinental Champion. I think as a heel, holding weekly open challenges out of arrogance and wanting to best his opponents every week could be awesome. Question, what do you think about weekly open challenges for a heel? And can it work? Or would the fans suddenly start cheering the heel out of respect? I do think, especially with Gunther, you run that risk. Because I think there's already a segment of fans who kind of want to cheer Gunther just because he's awesome and his chops make a lot of noise and that's fun for people who are there live. So it depends on the heel, I think, and it depends on how the heel goes about the open challenges. You know, does he try to stuff the ballot, so to speak, with weaker challengers? Does he win by weaselly means each and every week? So I don't think it's inherently not going to work as a heel, but if you do it straight, like you would probably with Gunther, you absolutely do run the risk, I think, Javier, of making that heel a babyface unintentionally.
Well, I mean, that's, yeah, because it's obvious. If you're playing the open challenge straight and you're doing it, it's an honorable reason. Even if you're, like, as conceited, you're doing it because you're conceited or whatever, ultimately you're sticking to honor, and that is a virtue that, you know, people would, you know, end up liking. You know, if you're a Star Trek fan, like, the Klingons, like, kill a bunch of people, but, you know, I'm talking about Next Generation onwards, the old series, they were more like communist. it was what they were based on. But like the later one, they made them kind of like Vikings. They were, you know, they were killers, but they had a system of honor, and that drew a lot of people into like liking the Klingons in the Next Generation era stuff. So that you will turn people, you will turn a Gunther babyface if you were to do something like that. And a heel has, and we have seen versions of heels holding an open challenge as a mockery, where, and then, like, you know, I have a, you know, open challenge, and then Tozawa comes up to keep burying the poor guy, even though he's like one of my favorite wrestlers.
I like Tozawa. I got nothing against him, but he's a perfect example.
I love Tozawa, man.
All right, final question from John, and it's about Jey Uso and his viability as a top guy in the long term. He has been a tag team guy for over a decade now, and some people can never let go of their perception of someone after that long. I'm not that belief, and I'm confident Jey can be a successful long-term champion if he's opposite the right opponents, because he's been the only guy in the bloodline this whole time who has had consistent morals and doing things for the right reasons to stand by his family. He has never fully switched allegiances until this past week, and he even confided in Sammy despite not trusting him at first, and then reluctantly dumped him because of his loyalty to the bloodline. He was conflicted. He believed Sammy was genuine, and he eventually welcomed him into the bloodline and felt the most betrayed when Sammy was essentially forced out because Jey was essentially brainwashed by Roman the whole time to be loyal to him. Once Jey's initial feud with Roman was over, he's been all in with the bloodline and devoted to him. I believe everything I just said gives some people the flawed impression that Jake cannot succeed outside the bloodline as the new undisputed Universal Champion long-term if he defeats Roman. Jay's a fantastic in-ring performer and great with body language and facial expressions, and has just been a great actor for a while now. He's even called main event Jay Uso, and I feel like he deserves a solo run at some point. Why not as undisputed Universal Champion post-bloodline? I think it's unfair to discount Jay as a tag team guy and deny him a run as a top guy. I believe he's more than earned an opportunity to prove himself as the top guy with the titles who takes over from Roman eventually. I believe Jimmy will face Roman at SummerSlam, like I proposed a few weeks ago, and Jay will face Roman at WrestleMania. Question, do you view Jay Uso as a long-term or transitional champion, or are you taking a wait-and-see approach? And again, this was sent a few weeks ago by John, and we're just kind of catching up to it. So, John makes the argument against the perception of Jay and really Jimmy, I think, as just tag team wrestlers. I don't know that anyone sees them as that anymore. I think the majority of people who are hooked with this bloodline storyline do view Jimmy and Jay, or Jimmy or Jay, as possible long-term singles champions. And so, you know, I may be in a wait-and-see approach right now, but if WWE decides, whether it's SummerSlam, whether it's WrestleMania, or whenever the case may be, to put the title on Jay, which is, it's looking more likely Jay than Jimmy at this point, I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think him being a long-term tag team wrestler is really going to hinder people's views of it because the bloodline storyline has been so strong. Javier, what's your view on Jay and or Jimmy as long-term singles wrestlers? And can fans set aside seeing them as tag team wrestlers for so long?
Danny O'Brien, right? Brian Danielson, however you want to call him, but I'm talking WWE. They were basically burying him, right? And crowds were still behind him, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I recall, yes.
I am asking because I was not watching closely at that point, so I want to make sure I'm my fact. So now, people, you know, no matter what he was doing, people were still behind him, even though like the engine and stuff weren't behind him. Now, look at the storyline that we've gotten with the bloodline with Sami Zayn and how Sami Zayn was over and heading into that the match. I forgot whatever it happened. You know, people are like, you know, oh, you know, Sami Zayn's going to win the match and Sami Zayn's going to be the one who's going to be the one who's throwing him, and everybody was on board Sami, you know, on top of Sami Zayn. And now look at Sami Zayn. People still like him, but is the same fervor there?
Is the what?
Is the same fervor there that there was when he was in that storyline? How much of what Sami Zayn was doing, you know, and it was a great story, and he did a great acting part. But once he's out of that storyline, how much of that storyline was what was driving into wanting to see him beat Roman Reigns? How much of that storyline was, you know, oh, he's going to be the one win and he's going to hold the championship? And now we move forward, and Sami Zayn is more over than he was before joining the bloodline, but is there still the same fervor of people wanting him to be the champion? There's not.
No, but I think his level was unsustainable. I just don't think that was something that you could really sustain, that level of heat that fans had for him when he finally did turn on the bloodline.
Yeah, but I think that's the same case with Jey Uso and or Jimmy Uso, more so Jey Uso. I mean, this is the closest that you've gotten with Jey Uso, you know. But Jey Uso is just to me like I'm gonna go with an analogy of that. Hopefully, more people get. Others gonna be a little weird. Do you watch Friends?
I don't. No.
No. Okay. So you know. Okay. Well. You have, I'll use that, but you know how you have a show where you basically have like a great cast and there's a cast member people really like, and that show was Joey. And then they gave Joey a spinoff and it kind of went nowhere. You know, the character, even though the character was one of the most beloved characters on the show, you know, and the spinoff didn't go anywhere because he was, once he's removed from the situation that made, you know, that, you know, because sometimes you're in a situation that you're part of something that is, you know, greater than some of the parts, you know, kind of thing. And once you remove that, it's just that. And that's the thing. I may be wrong. And I think this is the closest we've ever been to, like, maybe Jay can do it. but it's just like, I think, what's next? Who's mm-hmm. the next opponent? Am I going to be as excited, you know, because I am excited to see Jay take on Roman Reigns. Can I see myself be as excited to see Jay wrestle somebody outside of the bloodline? Gunther. Am I as excited for Jay and Gunther? I am more excited than I was, you know, when they were just a tag team X amount of years ago. You know, it is a more intriguing match. But am I, like, on the same – do I have the same fervor as seeing Jay beat Roman Reigns? You know, mm-hmm. you know, do I want to see Jay – you know, would I rather see Jay versus Gunther or Ilya Dragunov versus Gunther? I'd rather see Ilya Dragunov versus Gunther. You know, mm-hmm. that's, you know, personal case. So, I mean, it's possible. You know, maybe if they book it perfectly, you know, and do it great, I just do not think it's there, which is why I don't think that Jay's the one to beat Roman Reigns, because I don't. I think he is – he's the guy who's going to win the award for best supporting actors. And how many people have won the award for best supporting actor over and over again don't win the award for best actor?
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's not
knock.
That's not knock. It's,
right.
You know, it's, you know.
I would I'm certainly aware of Joey and his spinoff and all that, but I, for me, the closer comparison, you know, for shows that I watch would be Seinfeld, which was a wildly successful show. Everybody loved the cast, but when Michael Richards and Julia Louis-Dreyfus and, you know, Jason Alexander got their own shows to be the star of, they all lasted one season. You know, so, I mean, it was just you take them out of that element and all of a sudden ask them to play different characters and star as opposed to support, which I think is the argument you're making about Jay too. And it's a struggle. So yeah, I definitely get that argument. Javier, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Really appreciate the conversation. There are not many people who I can talk New Japan and Impact Wrestling with. So I appreciate your insight on both here tonight. And we'll certainly be covering both in the coming weeks. But before we let you go ahead and plug what you do for The Torch and where fans can find you on social media.
Well, I social media somewhere on Twitter. I never tweet anything, so right now it doesn't matter. I'll be returning with the New Japan Pride podcast with the G1 coming up. I don't think I'll be able to do the daily like I did last year, but I will, you know, regularly, you know, give you a results for two or three, you know, nights of the G1. I also do the primers for the PLEs for AEW AEW and WWE. Wow, I'm blacking out. It's getting late. But yeah, so and you know, oftentimes you know, help out Greg. I'm post shows with Wade, that sort of thing. So.
Well, Javier, I appreciate you joining me tonight. Thanks so much. And we'll be on the lookout for your G1 coverage on The Torch.
Always a joy, man.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And a lot of the stuff we talked about tonight, we're going to review. We did some previews tonight. We'll do some reviews in the coming weeks and, of course, have our eye on the G1 over the next month. Again, thanks for joining us. You can find us again next week, Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, Wrestling Night in America, because if it's Sunday, it is Wrestling Night in America.